From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the overturning of Roe v. Wade in June. In recent weeks, we've heard a variety of perspectives, including a group of suburban pastors last week who wrote a public letter defending a woman's right to bodily autonomy, privacy, and reproductive freedom. Today, we hear a different side. We welcome guests who maybe thought they would never see this Supreme Court decision, maybe not in their lifetimes, who cheered the decision while looking ahead to a future that might include very different family and child care policies. Our intention is to continue these conversations carefully, openly, and with a range of views. And there is a great deal of vitriol and noise on this subject. We know that. Our hope is to provide the opposite, really. We want to interrogate and understand viewpoints, examine the options for both voters and policymakers, and look at how our country is changing. For abortion opponents, one question they have long grappled with is this: what will it truly mean to be self-described pro-life after abortion is banned in many American states? And what else should have to change, too? Our guests this hour include the Vice President of Feminist Choosing Life of New York. That's Cecilia Lester, who's with us in studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And Carol Crossett is on the line with us, a member of Democrats for Life of New York. Carol, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Carol, did you think that you would ever see Roe overturned in your lifetime?
No, I really didn't. As a matter of fact, when it was overturned that day, I was on vacation with my grandchildren, and I woke them up. It was about, 10:30 in the morning. I got them out of bed, and I said, "You have to hear this, because this is historic." So I was just shocked, actually.
Cecilia, what about you?
Same thing. My mother especially was the first person I called because she's been involved in the pro-life movement for a long time, since the 1980s. You know, there's tears. I think we've heard that from both sides because it means that a lot of change is coming, and a lot of people are afraid of that, and we understand that. You know, I love the first part of what you said here. Conversation is so vital right now. This is such a contentious time. And I think when we actually do have conversations, we can see that we actually do have a lot in common. Obviously, there's things that we don't have in common. But when we speak openly on this, that's where we can find common ground. But we can also humanize each other and see that we're people. And a lot of people that are involved in this conversation are coming from a place of goodwill.
Well, what we know at this moment is that American states have a wide range of approaches to this. We saw instant banning of abortion. We saw different restrictions. Now there are different debates on personhood and exceptions, and we can talk about those things. But I want to address some of the writing and comments of a woman named Erica Bakiaki. She's a legal scholar at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center and the director of the Wollstonecraft Project at the Abigail Adams Institute. And she has argued for anti-abortion policies and the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But she's also sort of dramatically in favor of very different policies at state levels. And I want to read and get both of our guests' take on some of what Bakiaki said about that. First, as to what comes now, here's how she describes the current state of abortion access and family policy. Quote, "Red states are in this position of, now that Roe is overturned, they're standing on their accomplishment of just ending abortion. But in reality, they have pregnant residents basically facing poverty and substandard health care as compared to people in the blue states. The better answer is to have abortion restrictions and have pro-family policies. Are the red states doing it? No. Am I hoping to try to convince them to do it? Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the work of the pro-life movement going forward." End quote. Cecilia, do you agree with that?
Well, first, you're totally speaking our language. We love Erica. Carol and I have both met her. And I would say that anybody who's really interested in understanding what she's saying here more deeply must read her book. It's recent. It's called The Rights of Women. And in order to make the argument that she's making, she goes back in time to the origins of the women's movement. And then she brings us to today, and she talks about, you know, really how abortion on demand, and we're talking about elective abortion here, has flipped the intentions of the first feminists on their head. Those are her words. because it's made pregnancy and, you know, by extension, childbirth and child rearing, just this exclusive problem of the woman. So the term "my body, my choice" comes with this flip side of isolation. It's now all on you. Whereas, you know, not only did the woman not get pregnant on her own, but pregnancy and child rearing itself has always required profound communal support. So we need that both through the law and the culture. And I think that when she criticizes Republicans here, I think that the conversation needs to move in a lot of ways beyond Republican and Democrat. And that's one of the great things about our group is that we're nonpartisan and we're secular. So we have a big, what we believe is a big tent, and we want to hear solutions, and we don't want to pigeonhole them with one group or the other. We want to see what works and what doesn't work. And so I would say Erica is definitely, her work and her ideas here are just really inspiring to us, and we would say that she's just definitely a leader in this movement, and I would completely agree with everything that she's said there.
Let me just probe one other point that you're making here. When you talk about the phrase, "my body, my choice," and your sense and Bakayaki's sense that that we've moved far afield from maybe some of the original intents as she sees it of feminism, and feeling like "my body, my choice" is, I think what I hear you saying is can you describe a little again? Because what I want to make sure is I understand a certain point here, because I think some of our listeners may hear it differently, but go ahead.
Sure. Let me see if I can come about this in a different way. Well, so one of the things Erica talks about that's still lacking in the progress of women generally can be found in this lack of work-family flexibility, right? It's really hard to be a person who has dependents in a lot of ways. There's still a lot of things that need to be fixed with that. And then she really focuses a lot on the poor. You know, elective abortion itself was promoted from the beginning as the solution to poverty, and we can see that that has just not worked. And for women especially, when you look at the proportion of people who were poor in 1970 that were women, it was 44%, and it's 56% today. And so, again, we attribute that to this go-it-alone kind of thing that's accompanied Roe, where, you know, the decision being placed in her hands alone allows everyone around her to walk away and to escape that responsibility. I hope I've answered that.
Yeah, but I think people may hear that, people who take a different view than you, and they may say, look, my body, my choice means exactly what it means. And when you limit choice, it becomes often, not exclusively, but often, powerful men who are making decisions, taking choice away from women from their own bodily autonomy. And I want to make sure I square that with how you see my body, my choice has been somehow lost or violated with abortion on demand, as you described.
Well, I think it's worth remembering that the decision of Roe was decided by all men. And a lot of the abortion supporters in the beginning were men, including Bernard Nathanson and Larry Leder. So we would argue that abortion actually helps men because it relieves them of their responsibilities toward women. To return a little bit to placing some of the responsibility for the feminization of poverty on abortion, I mean, there is data to support that idea. I mean, if you look at the work of Nobel Prize winning economist George Akerlof, he found that abortion did just this. It made, by making the choice to continue the pregnancy, the choice of the woman, it made the choice to accompany her, the choice to accompany her of the father also, his to voluntarily accept or discard. And so they directly attribute, even though he's pro-choice, he does say that this change in behavior and of assumption of responsibility for parenthood came with Roe and is because of this widespread access to legal abortion. We also think beyond just like the cost analysis of whether it helps or harms women economically, because I think there can be maybe some arguments to say that it's helped elite women for sure. And as far as, you know, being the head of something is helpful, but we would argue that, you know, when you think of a human being, as this precious and irreplaceable child, no woman or family is truly helped ever by the destruction of that child or participating in the destruction of that child. And so just like Erica argues, we have to reframe what success means in this country, you know, and get more of a family oriented and rather than market oriented conception of that.
But that's an argument against contraception too, isn't it?
You know, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I can say that that's another area in which we maintain a Big Ten perspective on. We definitely have members of our group that are pro contraception and we don't see any issue with it, and would argue that it limits the number of unintended pregnancies. But we do have members for sure that, because George Akerlof also made the connection of contraception and abortion together, that don't see the solution being found in more contraception.
So one more question for you, and then I'll turn it over to Carol to respond to some of what Erica Bakiaki has written and said. I certainly take the point that you are concerned about poverty, women in poverty, the effect of poverty on children and families. And if you look at 1970 and you look at today, you're very moved by what you see there. Part of what Bakiaki is saying here is that in the red states right now, where these abortion bans are already in place or going into place or severely restricted, there very well could be more children born into poverty if the policies don't change. If we don't see true pro-life, you know, for lack of a better phrase or a phrase that people will use, policy for kids who are born into trauma, poverty, single parent situations, all kinds of different policy levers that do exist in some states, but not all, and often not in the red states. And so what I'm wondering is, if you also agree with Bakiaki there, then is there a chicken and egg situation? If you get what you want with abortion, should it be preceded by policies that will protect more children being born?
Oh, sure. I mean,
because that didn't happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would, except for the fact that in some of these red states, they all do have some sort of social programs that are already in existence. And by banning abortion and foreseeing the increase in children, they do foresee the increase in demands on those social programs.
Are they enough, though?
I would argue probably not. Again, I really think that the concluding chapter of Erica's book really lays out nicely some of the social programs that she would support. I mean, she echoes Becky Friedan or Pauli Murray in saying that, you know, in a lot of ways, we should acknowledge parenthood in the same way that we acknowledge a veteran, somebody who's provided this great service to the country. And, you know, maybe some of the things that we offer to veterans should be offered to parents who have dependent children as well. I don't know.
Okay. Carol Crossan, on the subject that Bakiaki is raising, that now that we are moving in this post-Roe world, there has to be much more urgency for childcare, pro-family, pro-parental support, et cetera, in any state that moves in that direction, and frankly, in all states. So do you agree there, and what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we might become a more purple country, right? We can learn from the red states, and the red states can learn from us. But I do think that the abortion, like in New York State, for instance, and in some of these states where it's nearly unlimited, I really believe that that actually disincentivizes providing better social services for women, right? I mean, like, we don't need to, right? So I think that
explain a little more, Carol. Why don't we need to?
Yeah, well, if you can give a woman an abortion and you make that easy for her, you pay for it, then you don't have to pay for her child care, for her education. You can give her $300 for an abortion and save taxpayers money, right? So I think it disincentivizes. Abortion disincentivizes providing better social services for women. And I think that we might be able to, we're going to have to learn from each other, aren't we, red and blue?
I understand that, certainly that last point. But why is it then that you think that the states that have the most expansive abortion access, New York being one of them, tend to have the most expansive support, you know, paid family leave, paid parental leave, that red states don't have?
We also have a very high poverty level, too. Do we not?
Certainly so, but that's not exclusive to this state. I mean, I don't know how exact. We could look it up. New York, probably. I don't know where we rank in terms of poverty per capita. It might be very high. I don't have it in front of me. We can look it up. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely poverty for sure. There's definitely poverty, especially in urban centers.
In Rochester.
Yeah. Oh, very, very much so. And this is something else that Bakayaki writes about that that I found sort of like compelling on the surface, but. Also, I was the more I thought about it, the more I found myself wondering. She's talking about women in poverty and the values that they may hold, and her feeling that that women in poverty who oppose abortion personally might feel like that's the only option they have for some of the reasons that Carol just described. Here's what Bakayaki said about that quote: "I think that actually in a lot of the lives of poor women, that they would choose not to have an abortion if they thought that they could afford to have a child. And so that is of great concern to me, that we're putting poor women in a situation where the best we can get, the richest country in the history of the world, is to offer them the means to have abortions." End quote.
And I think that's basically, there's this, the woman in Connecticut who just won her state primary, Representative McGee. She says that, you know, she's pro-life. She's a pro-life Democrat. And on the very reasons why you state, I mean, she's focused on racial justice. And she said that, you know, young black girls are told to actually use abortion as birth control. And she said she believes that the history of the abortion industry is destructive to the black race. And she talks about the number of women who, 14%, she says, that are of childbearing population in the black race have 36% of the abortions. And she said they don't want them. And yeah. So you're absolutely right. And Bakayoki's right.
Yeah, I would add to that, too. What Erica's saying here is borne out in the data from pro-choice organizations themselves. So Guttmacher has, as the leading cause of abortion for women, is a lack of resources and, you know, support, particularly from a partner. And so there is a coercive element there. I would hope that both pro-life people and pro-choice people could come to an agreement on that, that women shouldn't be having abortions just because they feel like they can't afford a child. And I think that those reasons also strike a little bit at the bodily autonomy argument that seems to dominate the conversation. I mean, if women were saying, you know, this is my body and this is an invader and I don't want this child in there, then I think that they would say that and the reasons that they give for abortions. And certainly that's the case for some women, but it doesn't appear to be the case for most women if most women are saying that they're more worried about what happens after the baby is born than the concerns about the pregnancy itself.
I can understand intellectually the argument. My concern in that particular passage from Bakayaki was sort of monolithically ascribing that viewpoint to all women in poverty, which I'm not sure she would argue she's doing. I think she's simply raising the concern that for women who truly don't want that, but they feel like there aren't options, they may feel cornered.
Right. Well, Charles Kamsey, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's another consistent life thinker. He's a pro-life Democrat. He's from Fordham University. He actually just recently had an article about a Gallup poll, which found that for people making under $40,000 a year that are people of color, that they only 30% of them actually agree with the official Democratic Party platform on abortion. And so he said that, you know, the people that are most affected by these policies are actually, they're more likely to oppose abortion themselves. And very often, you know, I did go to Congressman Joe Morelli's town hall that he had on abortion last month. And there was a lot of people speaking on behalf of poor women, but poor women were really not represented in that room. There was nobody on the panel and there was nobody in the room. And so that's something that's been shown by this research as well, is that very often privileged people prefer abortion for poor people than they prefer it for themselves.
New York is in the top 20 in terms of poverty as a state, but nowhere near a state like Mississippi and many other states in the contiguous South, which are banning abortion. So, you know, there's a lot of work, I'm sure, to do policy-wise in these areas if they're going to truly address the needs of children, of children who are now more likely to be born or born into poverty.
Well, I think that raises a fundamental question here also, and an assumption too. Like, are you better off dead than poor? I mean, is that what these people who are wanting abortion in these poor states are saying? It seems to me that that's what they're saying. You know, that's an offensive idea of life. And I think that's part of what Erica's talking about here, is that many poor people don't feel that themselves.
Yeah, I understand that point, but that, again, that also implies that there should be, you know, no limit to the number of children who are going to be born, that we shouldn't use contraception, that every family should have many, many children as opposed to a choice between them. I think that ascribes personhood to a developing fetus or embryo. Is that, would you agree with that?
I don't know. Can you rephrase that question? I'm not sure if
well,
I understand how it
I do understand what you're saying. That there's something offensive about saying you'd be better off dead than poor.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That I understand.
Right.
That I understand. But it's also, I don't know if that's the fair formulation, because what we're talking about is sort of a null set, a group of people that does not exist. And if a society is saying that...
Well, they do exist, though. I mean, they're alive. They're categorically, biologically.
That's what I'm asking. So
right.
Do you ascribe personhood to, you know, a blastocyst, an embryo, a fetus?
Well, that is just a human being, a human person at their youngest age. I think part of where we've seen a lot of miseducation from the pro-choice side is that they describe the development of human life as if it's in this mechanistic kind of way, that once you have a certain number of parts, then you're officially a human being. You know, we hear that with the clump of cells or the balls of cells type of phrasing, where
sure, yeah.
It implies that there's this undifferentiated tumor-like thing that's growing, whereas you know, the biology is quite clear. You know, human organisms are whole beings from the very beginning. And we mature and we develop over time. But, you know, quite early on, I mean, if you're looking for, the time that a child in the womb looks like a human, you know, we have this great video on our social media page. It's preceded by an app, a pregnancy tracker app, where they show an animation of a child that's 10 weeks from conception. And you can see the developmental milestones of the bones in the hand and clearly a face, and all the organs are there. You know, but even those animations are a bit of an abstraction. What we have that follows that animation is an actual child born 8 weeks from conception. Mom would have been 10 weeks pregnant because the child was growing in the fallopian tube. So obviously, pro-life people don't take an ethical opposition to that. We recognize there's cases where if the mother's life is endangered in this way, that this is fundamentally different than elective abortion. This is a necessary procedure. So this child was removed. And when you see this video, it's very unique because the child is still in the embryonic sac. And so they're moving freely. And they're being held in the palm of some sort of medical person's hand. You can see from the size, they're about an inch and a half long. And the way that they're swimming and moving is stunning. It's stunning because it's just like any baby I've ever had and held in my arms. And so, you know, as far as the personhood conversation goes, I think the pro-choice movement benefits from the abstraction of not seeing that life in front of you. But when you see that baby, I'll call them a baby, in a palm of a hand, and then you think, the purpose of the abortion is to crush that little life, I think it changes the conversation greatly, and we've had a lot of response in that way.
I don't think anyone in the pro-choice side would say the purpose is to crush a life. I mean, I think that's probably...
It's to end a life.
To end the life, or to end the development there,
yes.
Yeah. And so, but you bring up something that I think is really also important to understand here, and I want to ask both you and Carol about this. You brought up exception. And you say that, in your view, there is a reasonable exception. It's not elective abortion.
Right.
The doctor says there's a real risk to the life of the mother if this continues or during labor. And in that point, you think it's reasonable to say abortion, that is the exception that you would say, okay. Yes?
Yes, and I think that's been borne out in these states as well. Every single one of these states has an exception for that. And I would also say, you know, a lot of focus has been on rape as well. And you know, I think this is an area in which, you know, when we hear about that 10-year-old, right? Every person, whoever you are, is moved by that. And I think that if you're considering yourself pro-choice because of instances of life in the mother or because of rape, which accounts, according to Guttmacher, for less than 1% of all abortions, you know, we would argue you actually have more in common with the pro-life position than the pro-choice position, because the pro-life position is that, you know, this is an act that takes the life of an individual human being. And so it should be highly regulated and the last option used, whereas the pro-choice position, and this is Congressman Morelli's position and what he voted on in this state, is that abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy and taxpayer funded, you know, and that's a position that's very extreme, that, you know, according to a Harvard-Harris poll in July, 90% of Americans do not
agree
with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most Americans do not support the third trimester, abortion,
right,
and third trimester. That's true. And you're right that the vast majority of Americans, the latest Pew research is 73-8 Americans favor exceptions for the life of the mother. So this is one of the rare places where Americans sort of agree bipartisanly.
Right.
Although, here's why I bring this up. There are several states now, Wisconsin's one of them, there are growing movements to say no exceptions. And that could happen. We could see states, we are seeing red states consider no exceptions. And the part that intellectually I actually think is understandable about that I kind of want to probe with you and Carol is this. If that developing child is a person, just at a different stage of development, but a person, no less a person than you and me, a person that is not more valued or less valued than you or me. If you have a situation where doctors say, if this pregnancy continues, there is a chance the mother could die. Not certain, but there is a chance. If you abort the developing fetus, that is, in the construct that you're giving us, that is killing a life for sure. And if you go forward with the birth, the mother may die, but may not. So in one scenario, you have one person killed, and in another, you have one who may die, but may not. So to me, there's a logical, if your framework is that's a human being, no different, even as you say, you're right. Sometimes people say the clump of cells or the first
right.
few days of pregnancy. But if that's the same as you and me,
well, if
then
somebody,
how can you can condone?
If somebody's holding a gun up to somebody else, they may or may not kill them, right? But would it still be wrong to then take down that person that's holding the gun? No. We would say, like, they're using a equal threat of force against this woman's life. So I think that that's the standard generally, but you're still pointing to circumstances that are not the majority of abortions and really not... you know, would still fall under our categorization of highly regulated.
I hear you. I don't think it doesn't happen that often that
right.
a doctor would say
right.
the life is, but it can and does happen.
Yeah.
And I'm just intellectually trying to understand.
I would point you again to Charles Kamesey, because he has said that states need to be really generous in understanding that. And yes, this is a person, you know, this is a child that has value, but, you know, for sure early in pregnancy, they can't live without their mother. And so if the mother dies, then that's no good to the child anyway. And so he says that states really need to be craft these policies in such a way that we don't risk women's lives.
Okay. Carol, can you weigh in? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of a family member of mine who nearly died in childbirth with her first and was essentially advised, do not do this again. I mean, that for her, it wasn't the pregnancy, it was the labor that nearly ended mm-hmm. her life. And she was told
sure.
not to do this again. And that if
yeah.
she got pregnant, to end the pregnancy because that is too dangerous. Help me understand
I had morning sickness so bad when I was pregnant with my first child that I went down to 72 pounds. They said I was going to die. But I do think that these extreme positions, they're real, but I think overall they're a distraction.
Yes.
Because I think the common reasons for abortion that make up over 95% of why women get abortions are what has driven, the red states to do what they're doing. It's like, gun rights advocates, you know, they'll say that they need a gun because what if someone is raping your grandmother. We're all adults, and we know how to carve out exceptions to rules, and that's what we have. You know, we do it all the time.
No, I actually don't think it's a distraction. I mean, like, I think people on the pro-choice side are saying they don't think that this is a human life equal of value to people who are born and living. A six-month-old child, a six-day-old child, a 78-year-old person, a mother, whatever. They're saying they don't view, whether it's 3 days into pregnancy or 3 months, they don't view it the same. And you are saying you do, which I can respect, but you're also saying you would still willingly end that if there was a chance the mother's life would be affected. And I do think exploring that is valuable to seeing if you really believe it's the same. That's all I'm trying to understand. I'm not trying any sort of sleight of hand or just, all I want to do is understand what's the framework from which we're working. And when you say it's the same, it's no different. It's a human life.
I think,
a hard time getting my head around ending that life willingly.
I think some of the consumption, I'm sorry, Carol, I didn't mean to talk over you.
You both have plenty of time. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think some of that is born of coming from a different place when we try to assess the value of life. You know, we don't think that that's something that in most cases human beings are capable of doing, you know, because we have this terrible history of certain humans deciding that other humans either don't have value or their value is on some sort of a spectrum. And so we really are advocating for removing that hierarchy and saying that there's irreducible value there. It's not the grandmother has less value than the 35-year-old. It's that who are you to judge that? It doesn't seem like it's your place, and that's outside of human capability. So unless it's a case where there is an equal threat of force, right, and a significant, you know, risk to her life, then we'd say that that's not your life to just do with what you please.
Okay, Carol?
Yeah, well, you know, just last week I was in Connecticut, and I was able to visit the Harriet Beecher Stowe Museum, and she's, of course, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But it's fascinating how this very same conversation took place over slaves. You know, were they persons or were they human beings? And at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, the question of personhood is really sort of a metaphysical question. You know, in the Constitution, a corporation is a person. Sometimes I feel like my kids don't act like persons. But, you know, human being is more of a universal scientific truth. You know, when the egg and the sperm come together, it has the same DNA that create a human being. We don't create rodents or, you know, we are a human being. And I just found that so fascinating, this conversation that was going on about slaves.
Can I add one thing to that also? So another basic pro-life idea also is that, and this is very much connected to the founding principles of this country, is that we're all created equal, which means that your rights, your value, your dignity is inherent to your existence, right? So if we change that so that it's you only have value, you only have worth, you only have dignity when someone else says that you have it, then we really completely upset what rights are and where they come from. And I would argue that you actually undermine the idea that abortion is a fundamental right itself, because if rights are just what those in power give you, then why don't we just elect people who think that there is no right to an abortion? You know, so I think that idea rights is inherent to existence is the progress toward which we've been trying to strive since the country's founding, and that really the life of the child in the womb is maybe hopefully the final frontier on that, where we really commit to seeing, you know, human life not as an object, that it can never be an object to be owned or used or abused or discarded by somebody else, but as, you know, just a value for being, and that they have this life, not only the life that they have then, which, you know, we can all agree they can't think, they can't do much, but they have, you know, everything ahead of them. And that's the same good that's taken from anybody that's unjustly killed, is their right to their future and their right to pursue excellence. And I hope that helps explain us a little bit here too.
After we take our only break of the hour, I want to ask our guests about how they view living and working in New York State. I mean, this is you heard Carol Crossett, a member of Democrats for Life of New York, and Cecilia Lester, vice president of Feminist Choosing Life of New York, say that really in their lifetime, until recently, there wasn't a thought that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned. And now we're in this 50-state tapestry, of which they happen to be in a state with some of the strongest abortion rights. But is that also something that they think is probably immovable? Or do they now see that differently? What are the goals here? What does their work entail here? Or does their work end up shifting to states where the laws are shifting? So we'll talk about that and a lot more with Cecilia Lester and Carol Crossett next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center and other groups that monitor hate crimes, our country has seen a surge in hate crimes to record levels in recent years. Why is that? What would change that? How do we start to get along with one another better? How do we turn down the vitriol and the anger and, yes, the hatred? Some young people with some important ideas next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So our guest said that at the outset of this conversation, that Roe was sort of a frontier that they didn't expect to see fall. And similarly, I think a lot of people would say that they'd be surprised to see New York State change its laws. But at the same time, you have a Republican candidate for governor who is supporting overturning Roe and presumably would do all he could at the state level to change policy. A number of Republicans running for office. Although, interestingly, on this program, a state Senate candidate told us that abortion is a distraction. Republicans are not interested in that at the state level. That would not be on the radar. They don't care about it. They're interested in other issues. So let me start with Cecilia Lester, Vice President of Feminist Choosing Life of New York. Does your focus stay here? Is there work in this state post-Roe?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yes?
Oh, yes. Well, I think that going back to that Harvard-Harris poll that I mentioned about 90% of Americans opposing abortion beyond 23 weeks, I would assume that many New Yorkers are part of that 90%. And I think that people in New York State are actually quite unaware of how extreme our laws are here. And one of the things that causes us great anxiety, our organization great anxiety, is that with an equal rights amendment to the New York State Constitution, if the way that our laws are now is enshrined in the Constitution, it will become almost impossible to correct some of these really terrible ideas. I would say that there's a tremendous amount of work on the education front, particularly because people just don't know what our laws allow. And if they knew, I think that we would have a lot of people who would be willing to moderate significantly from those views.
Carol?
Yeah, I think we've got our work cut out for us in New York. I feel like I am pleased with a lot of the resources and social programs that are provided for women and their children. There's no question about it. But we have to have parity with the unborn and to address this unmitigated, what I consider unmitigated individualism. And I think that it's we're doing it with guns. We have to do it with guns. We have to reduce our number of guns. And I don't think that that's extraneous to this conversation. We are required to have logical limits to our freedoms and reduce violence in the world. And I think we have to do it with guns, and I think we have to do it with abortion.
An email from Melanie says, are they suggesting the man should now be forced to pay child support? I have a hard time believing that will happen. I'll start with Carol. What would you say to Melanie?
Wow, they certainly should. They absolutely should. I think it's really easy to be a pro-choice man because, I think that we have to require this. And that's one of the things that Erica Bakayoko does talk about, is that there is an asymmetry with the responsibilities and the care. And so much of this does fall on women. And it's required that we extend that responsibility to men. Absolutely.
Yeah, and abortion doesn't change that asymmetry because that's just a reality. I mean, we bear much more significantly the consequences of sex. And so, Yeah, I would agree. I think Georgia actually has enacted some sort of child support in utero. We would agree with that completely. Charles Camisi has suggested a national network for child support from fathers that would demand that. But some of it is going to have to come from responsible sexual practices. And I know that's a difficult thing for people to hear, but, you know, one of the things that George Agerlof found in that study that I pointed to earlier was that Roe dramatically changed the way that people have sex. It made it so people who would never want to be parents are now coupling. And you have to think about that seriously. Like, is this a person that I want to be attached to for life? And we would argue that you have that attachment whether you have the abortion or not. I mean, that is a child that you conceived with this other person, even if it was a casual encounter. And so there has to be some rethinking of that. And we actually think that that's been a positive thing in other states that people have said, OK, we have to be more specific of what we want from another partner. And we think that's actually a pro-woman thing because, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction from women with sexual encounters today between men and women. And they do want, it would seem, not all, but many do want more of a commitment. And they find that the expectations are such that commitment is not assumed.
So you feel like, and I think, as you said, Becky Uckey's written about this too, that this is a biological difference here, that men are, sometimes for chemistry reasons, a little more driven and willing to have sex in casual encounters. Women, as a whole, speaking monolithically, tend not to be and want more attachment. And that a post-Roe America would favor what a woman wants in those relationships.
Hopefully. I mean, and that's also, you know, we hear a lot of free agency, right? You still have that. I mean, you get to choose with whom and when and whether or not to take precautions when you have sex. I mean, that doesn't go away. And this idea that pregnancy is just like catching a cold, that it's just going to happen to you, you know, I think that really infantilizes a woman and says, like, that you don't have any control over this when you really do.
But, you know, most women I hear don't describe their desire to avoid getting pregnant, even if they are interested in casual sex, as treating it like getting a common cold. I don't think they're that blasé.
Oh, sure. But I mean, I think that if you look at the way that it's talked about, I mean, there are pro-choice advocates out there that literally describe it as falling pregnant, as if it is, you know, this unavoidable thing. You know, maybe that's a little anecdotal on my behalf, but
yeah,
I haven't heard that argument.
I'm not saying that argument hasn't been made. I'm just saying I haven't heard it. But on the subject of sex, I'm open to the idea that there are biological differences, broadly speaking, driven sometimes by chemistry or our bodies. But I also know that there are, you know, plenty of women who again, I don't want to be flip, but willing to have casual sex or interested in encounters that don't come with commitment, feel empowered about that. And I think they are seeing what's happening. They read not just the Roe decision from Alito, they read Thomas, and they hear and they feel this creep against even contraception. And they don't see, their perception is not that the self-described pro-life movement is not sort of monolithically standing up saying, hey, we're against abortion, but we want you to have options. We want you to have contraception. They don't hear that. And I'm wondering if you think they should hear that, Cecilia.
I mean, I will just tell you that as the social media director for Feminist Choosing Life of New York, I follow hundreds of pro-life accounts and individuals, and I just don't hear any sort of cry from them for an end to contraception. I mean, again, I think there's definitely people who, for the reasons I described earlier, aren't all rah-rah contraception as the solution to ending abortion, but I don't see any of them advocating for making it illegal. And as far as the women that do want to go and have more casual sexual encounters, I would ask them to consider whether this is affecting women generally. I mean, if it's affecting the expectations of sex generally. I mean, I think that's a little bit of a privileged position in a lot of ways because, like Erica argues, there's this trickle-down effect of hurting poor women. I mean, when that, you know, assumption of no responsibility for a child that's conceived trickles down to the poor, it just makes it that much harder to go through with a pregnancy and raising a child.
But people who are poor also have poorer access to good contraception.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is a conversation that probably would involve a whole nother show. And I think that, again, there are people that are involved in our group that would be in 100% agreement with you. I mean, speaking on behalf of our organization, I would say, you know, we're big tent. We would engage in that conversation. I just think that it's probably one that's, you know, longer than this.
Carol, you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I would love to see a program from a pro-life perspective interviewing some minority women and talking with them about these very same questions that you're bringing up. They're very important questions. But, you know, contraception isn't 100%. You know, if contraception works 99% of the time, and I think, again, we like to quote Guttmacher Institute because they're formerly an arm of Planned Parenthood and they are pro-choice. If contraception works 99% of the time, that's going to mean a lot of unwed, out-of-wedlock children. It's going to mean, you know, more children being born that weren't intended. It's going to mean more abortions. So I find it interesting when, you know, someone's on birth control and then they say that I found myself pregnant. I can't, you know, what do you mean you found yourself pregnant? You are on birth control, and we all know it doesn't work 100% of the time. I'm for birth control. I mean, I think that it's, you know, I think it's great. I mean, I think we do need to make sure that availability of birth control is out there. But at the same time, you can't engage in sex and at the same time be surprised if your birth control doesn't work. And I would not be in favor of that person getting an abortion. I don't believe abortion should be used as a birth control method.
Robert in Rochester says, in Florida, people are now getting a tax deduction for their unborn child. Is that something that should happen, Cecilia?
Yes. Yeah, you support I totally that. Agree. Yeah. Yep.
Carol, same?
Absolutely.
Another question from a listener who says that in a post-Roe America, we're going to see a significant number of girls, not young women, not adult women, but girls who become pregnant sometimes intentionally, sometimes accidentally, sometimes by force. If they don't have families that can provide for them, is it okay to force young girls to go through a pregnancy against their will? I would argue it's not. That's what this listener is saying. Cecilia?
Well, I mean, gosh, there's like five different arguments in that comment at once. So I'll try to pick that apart a little bit. But, you know, we don't really recognize it as forcing someone to give birth or have a child, considering that, you know, the child is... they already exist, right? And they have to exit the body either alive or deceased, right? And so we say because they're already alive, they should be born alive. And that just because of the circumstances of in which they're brought into the world are not ideal, that just doesn't remove, again, this dignity and value that's inherent to who they are. And we would also argue that, does this really help this woman or girl long term? I mean, again, to point to those poverty statistics, it hasn't. I mean, we've had so many abortions, and these rates of poverty are really quite stagnant. So,
if a girl's 12, if a girl's 13.
I mean, again, I think, again, to point back to what I said earlier about if you're holding out for those circumstances, you know, somebody like Charles Camus, who I've continued to talk about because I think he's really good at building bridges between the pro-life and pro-choice side. But he would argue that a case like that could be constituted as an equal threat of force against a child's life. And so, you know, there could be states that offer exceptions for those cases. And, you know, that he thinks that in doing that and allowing that exception, you probably could get more of the support of America because they don't want to see abortions outright banned. So that's been borne out in the polls too, that even slight majorities in that Harvard-Harris poll would support bans on abortion except for rape, incest, and life of the mother. In those circumstances, apart from the law, we would still do all we could to to walk with that woman and help that woman. I think even within those exceptions, we probably have to see really that really narrowed down, because oftentimes with a child, they're not finding out they're pregnant until much further along. So that's something that consistently we find with later term abortions. These are women that are younger, and they tend to find out much further along that they're pregnant. And so if we're talking about, we find this out at 22 weeks that this girl is pregnant, I mean, can she wait till 24 weeks? Can we perform a C-section? And then, I mean, what good does it do to have her deliver a child deceased? It doesn't make sense. So, yeah, so I think that those are areas in which pro-life people really could come to some sort of mediation with pro-choice people. But again, we have to recognize those as the outlying cases.
About 45 seconds. Carol, what about you?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Cecilia said. I think that was, you know, well stated. But I think again, it's an exception to the rule, and I feel like the exceptions have to be stated and created as part of the law, and these exceptions have to be carved out. But you still. You know, I think folks who exercise, you know, for instance, you exercise your right to drink, right? But you give up your right to drive because taking a life is at stake. And I think that, like any right, there are limitations on the consequences of exercising your rights. And so...
Well, the music does mean we've hit the end. But briefly, Cecilia Lester, with the Roe news, do you see a future where New York overturns abortion in this state? Is that possible?
I doubt entirely, but I think we will definitely back away from these later term abortions, which are shocking and which, if you speak openly about this with the public, they don't agree with at all.
Is that priority one for you right now?
Yeah. I mean, priority one is to not have these extreme laws be built into our Constitution.
Cecilia Lester is Vice President of Feminist Choosing Life of New York. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Carol Crossed, member of Democrats for Life of New York. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Evan.
And as I say every time we talk about this issue, this is one in a series of many conversations with many different viewpoints, and those will continue. More connections coming up in a moment.